Greg Masters reporting from Exponential Medicine here in the beautiful Hotel Del 2017. My privilege to introduce you to Dr. Rafael Grossman, who's a general surgeon and an early adopter in social media, as well as some of the tools like Google Glass. Hi, Rafael.
Hi, Greg. Pleasure to be here. Honored to be here.
Good to see you in person today. And so let's start with a little bit about you. You're a general surgeon. And you've been drawn to technology. Talk a little bit about that process for you. Where to begin?
Yeah, I'm a general surgeon. I'm a trauma surgeon. I do trauma and critical care. The other half of what I do is non-emergency stuff, like elective surgeries, general surgeon, bread and butter surgery. But also I've been doing advanced laparoscopic surgery and robotic surgery. So all those technologies in surgery, used in surgery, make me a little bit of a technophile, you know, because we need those tools to do a better job as surgeons. And that's probably where the sort of the background, the affinity for technology comes from. And I've been lucky enough to evolve in a way that makes me closer to the use of this exponential technologies in order to do a better job. Not just caring for patients, but a better job educating the future generations of physicians or providers, as well as patients and patients' families. So I really think that technology used in a smart way allows us to communicate and connect better. And those two things are really the main problem, I think, the main reason why healthcare is in the somewhat disastrous state that it is today in the year 2017, in most or all over the world, but especially in places like the U.S., where we should have a healthcare system with the technologies available today that we can't even imagine, and we don't.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that in a minute. I want to ask you first, I hear an accent, and you're not from Brooklyn or a Southie. Where's that accent from?
I'm Venezuelan. I'm from Venezuela. I grew up, born and grew up in Venezuela, went to med school in Venezuela, very proud of that. And after med school, 7 years of med school, I did the 1 year of rural service that you have to do as a payback to the society, because med school is free. Sort of a socialized, in a way, education, the way it should be, I think. And then I did a year of rural practice, then I got my diploma. And then the second year after that, I was working, I was learning English, and I was then also studying to take my boards because I wanted to do general surgery, but I wanted to train general surgery in a place where I could really reach for the stars in a way. You know, I chose the United States, and I really wanted to train the best way possible. And to do that, I had to go through a lot of hoops that I did. And then I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Well, I went to Chicago for a year, continued to learn my English and getting into research and getting to know the system, and then I applied to a residency, and I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, doing my residency in general surgery for 7 years. And a few months after I finished my residency, I went back home with my wife and three kids, and I tried to go back home to where I was going to spend the rest of my life, I guess. But you know, things turned different for many reasons. You know, different podcast, you know, different theme. But ended up with a lot of opportunities to come back to the States, and then my wife and I decided to come back. We love New England, so we selected a few places that were, and I ended up in Maine, which is where I've been for 14 years.
As far as the Venezuelan situation, unfortunately, it's got from suboptimal to worse right now, and it's really, really a sad situation.
It is. It's, you know, when we got back, it was sort of the beginning of the end, I call it, because it was a process that luckily we had the vision, you know, my wife and I had the vision of what the future is going to bring for our kids. And despite all our families being there, we took the hard call, the hard decision, made the hard decision to leave. And you know, these days, you know, you leave and you still see them and they come and go, but it's turning to a point where it's very hard to be able to even go back, you know, for safety and for many other reasons. So you know, everything goes in a circle. I believe that strongly, and our circle is not complete yet. It'll get better. You know, we have a beautiful country, we have an amazing human resource, amazing natural resources, you know, the largest oil reserves in the the world, and we have not used that in a wise way. It's like using technology in a smart way. We haven't used our potential or our resources in a smart way to be what we could be. You know, in the 50s, the Bolivar, which is the currency in Venezuela, was above the dollar as the preferred for about 3 years. So people would buy Bolivars rather than dollars. Imagine that. And now where we are, you know, it's pretty sad. But anyways, we took the jump, and it was good in a way, because I think that I've developed my potential, I'm developing my potential much faster, at least, than I could have done there. And also spread out, you know, the not, you know, personal gain, is really spread out what I could do to help in a much better way living here and developing here than I could have done staying there.
So you put down roots in Maine. Why general surgery? What drew you to trauma?
Well, my father is a surgeon, but that we're eight kids, and I'm the only one in medicine. So I don't think it was my father, but I just wanted to. I've been always keen of using my hands and you know, tools and technology and doing things and, you know, getting results quickly. And you know, I went from wanting to know everything and be, let's say, an internal medicine doctor, that idea of then to liking kids and wanting to be a pediatric fellow, you know, a specialist. And then thought maybe emergency, you know, you kind of take care of problems and save lives. And then I kind of at the end almost of med school, I thought, you know, I really want to be a surgeon. I mean, surgeon, you can. Surgeons, you know, we think we know everything too, but you know, you don't have to limit yourself, and I really wanted to be able to have an impact quickly, you know, on some things that if you're not a surgeon you can't, you know, operations and advice and prevention, all those things are very important. And trauma is something that I got drawn to, maybe because where I grew up, you know, and then laparoscopy was added on when I was in Chicago, was in the animal lab in Chicago. Unfortunately, we were using animals still back then, doing laparoscopic surgery in dogs, you know, in canine models, doing resections of colon, you know, segments of colon or bowel, and then putting them together laparoscopically. We're talking in the 90s, in 1993, you know, when laparoscopy was barely humans were getting cholecystectomies, and we're doing colectomies in dogs. And then robotic surgery came along, and I did a program in Beth Israel, sort of a mini fellowship for 10 weeks in advanced laparoscopy. I did the Top Gun program with James Butch Rosser in Beth Israel in New York, and that exponentially opened up my eyes on how to, you know, do minimally invasive surgery. And then ended up in Maine and started. I was the third surgeon in the program where I am now, and I wanted to be in a place that was raw, that we could create to what we wanted to create. And we were the first program verified by the American College of Surgeons in trauma in Maine ever. We did that, and then developed a program that has acute care surgery and trauma as the backbone, but also almost a third of what we do is elective surgery and laparoscopic, advanced laparoscopic robotic surgery. So it's pretty rewarding in that sense, you know, but not completely rewarding, because I've had this parallel life of me, which I do luckily not out of the need, because I do have a day job in a way, which is day and night job being a full-time surgeon, but also in my time off, and I've been juggling the time, and it's difficult sometimes to become an innovator, sort of a radical exponential thinker and influencer and active in healthcare social media, and trying to, you know, to preach out, you know, the power of technology used in a wise way, in a smart way, to change how we do healthcare and teaching healthcare.
So just for context purposes, community hospital, regional medical center, teaching affiliate. What's the?
Yeah, we have a tertiary care center in Bangor, Maine. Everything that I do, just for the records, you know, it's in digital health, and it's also my own. I'm a full time employee for them. But the hospital is a tertiary care center, about 400, 450 beds. It's a center of reference for two-thirds of the state of Maine, and that's an area larger than New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts altogether. You know, Maine is a very large state, only 1.5 million people, I guess. But you know, we have three Da Vinci robots. You know, that tells you all. So it's a very, very high-tech oriented place.
Excellent. So you get on staff at this hospital. You go about your business as a general and trauma surgeon, and somehow you stumble into the world of social media and Twitter specifically. Talk a little bit about that journey, and then let's get to the Google Glass story.
Well, you see, I remember in 2011 when the iPhone 4 came out, I had an iPhone, and so I got the news about the new platform and the new apps and FaceTime, which doesn't allow you to basically talk to someone by video like Dick Tracy did on his watch, you know. And then I saw, wow, you know, I've been helping developing the telemedicine program at Eastern Maine. I come from Venezuela, where I have a TEDx talk that I did in Bermuda that tells a little bit of how I think my time in the Amazon doing my rural service in a way seated this on me, you know, about connecting and having the expertise of someone, you know, helping you take care of patients. But in any case, I thought, wow, this would be great. Instead of using this $100,000 system for telemedicine, why don't we just use phones? And then that migrated to, well, phones are expensive. Why don't we use iPod Touch? That is the same as a phone, you know, in a way, in regards to video and Wi-Fi connected, and you have to pay for the cellular service and whatnot. So I started debugging my hospital about that, and finally we opened up a pilot program, and we selected a few sites. We had about 3 or 4 sites for telemedicine, and we grouped to about 7, and then I personally and the team delivered some iPads and iPod Touches to this, and created sort of a protocol, a pilot program, to do acute trauma consultations on a little device rather than the big camera, you know, the big systems. And, you know, mobile, all with you. They want you and they beep you and you just open the camera, boom, boom, and you're connected with the provider. So that kind of got into the radar of the local TEDx ecosystem in Maine, TEDx Dirigo. And they asked me to do a talk, and I did, and I felt, wow, this is amazing. How can you communicate? How communicating an idea, you know, worth sharing, which is the motto of TED, as you know, it has such an impact and potentially, you know, limitless, you know, advantages. So I started doing Twitter. You got to do Twitter. So, and I use Twitter and LinkedIn for healthcare-related digital health in social media. I don't even have Facebook, you know. I'm reserved in that way. I think that, you know, my private life, but then the power of social media, Twitter, LinkedIn, and others, you know, and to really get your voice out there and also to learn from out there, you know, that I thought that was incredible. And then I started doing more and more Twitter, more and more LinkedIn, getting connected, and then learned about Singularity University, Daniel Kraft. Then for 2 or 3 years, I kind of explored doing the exponential medicine version of Singularity. It was called Future Med, as you know, that's where we met, right? And 1 year I said, you know, I got to do this. So I did it. It was an investment, you know, but it changed my life. Then I went to this, it was a little bit very different to exponential medicine. Less of a conference, more of a program, almost of a fellowship or a master's, you know, for 7-8 days, 90 people were there, like being bombarded with exponential ideas in healthcare, how to transform healthcare. And one of the technologies was Google Glass, and when I saw that, it was the same click in my brain as when I saw FaceTime, you know, in the iPod. I said, wow, this can so I nailed the Babak Parvis, one of the inventors of Google Glass, and a few months later got a Google Glass in one of the first ones, you know, a group of explorers, a couple thousand people I think in the world had Google, so I got one. And then my argument was about doing telemedicine and integrating the medical record to this little rear view mirror, you know, in front of the face, and the potential I thought was unlimited. And then I ended up doing an operation with Google Glass, which was the first operation ever, and it was simple. I did the operation, I got permission from my patient and the family and the team, and basically did an operation the same way I always did it, but instead of the students being right behind me trying to see what I was doing, they were sitting, you know, next door, you know, looking at my perspective of things, my point of view of things, talking to me, answering my questions, asking me questions. And I thought, well, that's good. So I wrote a little post about that in a humble blog that I had before. And my friend John Nosta from Nosta Labs, he said, can I write a little? Yeah, sure. And he did. And a couple hours later, I guess he had a few thousand hits. And this kind of started this snowball of wow, this is amazing. And then I became sort of slowly a more active person in the sphere of innovation and healthcare, and being a keynote speaker, always looking for places where I can go and deliver keynotes to impact. You know, I don't do it that's not my business. I'm a surgeon, but I think that I have the responsibility to tell about the potential of technology to have things be better than what they are now. So.
And that really feeds your mission about better connection, better communication, better outcomes.
Absolutely, 100%.
So let's talk about exponential medicine. So you're an expert, you really are, in this space, pioneering technology into the clinical setting. So we hear a lot about AI, VR, machine learning, blockchain, all this stuff. How are you assimilating it, and where do you see the most practical applications in the clinical setting or even on the analytics outcome side?
Yeah, well, there are so many technologies out there, as you know, that that are very well explained and described in exponential medicine. And that's a reason to come, because you really get exposed to this amazing stuff that's happening out there. And, you know, from our talk, it was mostly focused to VR and AR and mixed reality, and how these platforms have the potential to make health delivery, healthcare delivery, and education of health care much better than what it is now. I think that there's certainly, these are tools that are going to be ubiquitous, are going to be used commonly, as common as the phone is used right now, not maybe substituting older technologies, but augmenting those technologies to make the process better. So, augmented, or, you know, artificial intelligence, AI, or augmented intelligence, as some people, including me, call it, robotics, you know, blockchain, you know, how do these technologies can be applied to make healthcare better and education better? Well, it's just a matter of just having a little bit of imagination. I think the only limit is our creativity, really, to how we can use these things. Augmented reality, augmented intelligence in healthcare, the potential of that, the possibilities of having a system that is better than you at looking at things, at remembering things, at analyzing things, at coming to conclusions based on numbers and objective data. Why not? Am I going to be out of a job? No, not at all. I'm going to be able to be better human doctor, have more time to be what a computer cannot be. Empathetic, sympathetic, you know, hold your hand, give you a hug, cry with you, laugh with you, while not having to remember what the drug that is best in the latest, analysis for whatever disease. So I think that technology empowers us to be much better humans. And yeah, many professions within healthcare and professions in general, in any discipline, within healthcare, many professions are going to be faster changed by the use of technologies like this. But I don't think that, you know, we're going to have to evolve. Just like technology evolves, you know, human processes will have to evolve, and we'll, at the end, end up with a better product, I think.
And I think you had mentioned that Google bet on the wrong vertical for the glass product. In fact, had it been nested inside the enterprise, i.e. specifically, let's say, the OR, they might have had much greater traction, faster iteration on the product, and greater utility for the surgical community?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a marketer, you know, I'm just a surgeon, but I don't even, you know, have an opinion about that. I thought the Google Glass Explorers program was brilliant. You select a bunch of people in different fields and ask for arguments to why you're allowed to buy one of these devices, and then, you know, come up with case scenarios, you know, for using the technology in any discipline out there. You know, it's hard to understand why it wasn't a success. I see Google Glass as the Model T, I always say, of smart glasses or of head-mounted computers. Model T, like the Model T was the first. Now you have Tesla, but Model T is not a failure. It was just sort of the first step in the process of developing to get a high-end car like we have now. I think, you know, after Google Glass, yeah, there was a lot of bad press. I think there was a lot of uninformed bad press or bad publicity about Google Glass and privacy and whatnot. You know, it's like the phone. You can be filming. It's not the technology. It's not the hardware or the device. It's the human using the device that is really ethical or unethical. And I think that was the case with Google Glass. But for whatever reason, Google Glass certainly went kind of down. People say it's dead. It's definitely not dead. Google Glass is thriving in the enterprise, and specifically in healthcare. There's a few companies out there. You know, you look at that Stry in Spain. It used to be called Reuters. You have AMA in France and the US. You have Augmedics. You know, I met the Augmedics founders by the way of Omero Rivas, innovation officer in Stanford, a friend of mine, surgeon, innovator from Mexico originally, like I am from Latin America. And Omero over sushi after I had presented a talk on mobile health platforms for his MOOC in Stanford, met these two, you know, gentlemen, young guys who had this idea, and I signed the NDA right there at the sushi place, and they told me about their idea for using Google Glass for a virtual scribe, and I thought it was fantastic. 4 years later, look at them. They are in, I think, 18 hospitals, 19 hospitals in the U.S., using the technology in a smart way to making the process better. You know, they have a virtual scribe sitting in the U.S. somewhere, or in Bangladesh, I think they are, and they're your personalized scribes populating the medical record that we all need to populate. But rather than having me do it or write down everything I say or see, they are doing it in live streaming. And then it's all protected, it's all HIPAA compliant and whatnot. They have a nice business model. And then what you do is you put the thing on the device and be the best human doctor you can be without having to do anything with data, with recording or writing anything down. And at the end of the day, you go down or, you know, go to the medical record, it's all there. You just edit and sign and go to the next patient, you know? And it's not artificial or augmented intelligence, it's human intelligence on the other side, writing down everything you say, and it's personalized, so you can, you know, it learns from you. The more you use your personal scribe, the more it's like your friend, and, you know, puts things in the chart as you would do it. So
love your enthusiasm. Let me ask you this: as an early adopter in these technologies, were you a beacon to other of your colleagues, or did they kind of look at you as a unique species?
That's a tricky question, I think, because I think it's hard. You know, I talk about the three pillars of obstruction to what we do. You know, in many things, but in digital health, I think you know, we have cost. You know, the economics of it. We have a cultural education. You know, of everyone in regards to the new paradigm shifts, you know, and then we have regulatory barriers, depending where you are, but there are always some type of too much regulatory and not regulatory is as bad, you know, but it's hard to be in the middle. And I think that, you know, culturally or education wise, it's hard to be sort of a too much of a disruptor, you know. People talk about disruption, and, you know, I love the Eric Topol, also the creative disruption. I try to be a creative disruptor in a way. My brother actually told me once that he met Nicolás Negroponte, the founder of the MIT Media Lab. Years ago, he went to visit Venezuela, and after 2 days in Venezuela, he said that Venezuelans had a healthy disrespect for authority. And I think that's what it is. He nailed it, you know. It's got to be Nicolás Negroponte to nail it, because I think that's true. But it's hard I want to see myself as a beacon, if not locally to where I am, and I think I might be a little bit, certainly not within the hospital maybe, or within the community, but certainly in the state, certainly in the region, and, you know, in the world. I mean, I've had so many people that have reached out to me, and people that I have reached out to exchange information, ideas, passion, that I just want to say that it has been fantastic, and much, much good than bad, in almost always.
Well, there you go. I mean, in this community, you have most of the DNA of the doers are people who subscribe to the 'tis better to ask for forgiveness than permission camp.
My motto.
So let's conclude with this. Just finished a breakout session with Brennan Spiegel on VR. And tell us a little bit about basic themes there, and then we'll wrap it up.
Well, in regards to AR and VR and mixed reality, I think the possibilities are really endless. Really, we're seeing the tip of the iceberg. I think it's just a communication tool, a connecting tool that is going to be very, very, very common within 5 years. You know, we talked about creating, you know, a virtual reality libraries, you know, like a VR Netflix type library of procedures, of procedures from complex surgical procedures to simple procedures, to not just talking doctors, but talking nurses, talking patients, you know, how to take your drugs, how to put this bandage on, how to care for your cast, or simple things. teaching, communicating and connecting ideas and people using these technologies is the future for sure. And everything, you know, hardware and software based is just getting better. And I mean, exponentially, you know, redundantly saying, but exponentially better, cheaper, smaller, faster, sexier, you know, all these things are really, I sometimes think, you know, 5-10 years from now, we're going to laugh at how we say, oh, you know, you think this is going to catch up? Well, of course it is. You know, it's like just the evolution. You know, I love the evolution with an R before it. You know, the revolution is really the evolution. Sometimes it's so exponential that it looks like a revolution, but that's where we're going.
So, good thing, bad thing from a technology standpoint. Some people think technology creates distance between the practitioner, the healer, and the patient. What's your take?
Well, I think it's really about the user. You know, it's I think technology is completely the opposite. I think something like Google Glass can make our interaction more direct. I'm looking at your face, I'm looking at your eyes. I only look at the glass screen when I need to look at that rear view mirror information behind me. But it has the potential to really make us closer. And you know, we talk about empathy, we talk about sympathy. We had a session at Exponential Medicine that was phenomenal, you know, talking about the hashtag empathy deficit. I think one of the worst things in medicine today, not just in the acting of medicine, healthcare, but the teaching of medicine, is the lack of empathy. You know, the best way to become a provider, a physician or a nurse, is becoming a patient, being the other person's shoes. And really, what kind of care would you provide if you were in those shoes? And I think that technology helps us do that. There are actually VR tools that allow you, and AR tools and other tools that allow you to hack into your own body and become the patient. So, to me, the you know, that'd be an awesome tool in medical education, to have the student. You don't want to make the student sick, but you can make them almost feel the same symptoms by ways of electricity or pressure or VR and AR, so that they can really feel how it feels, you know, to be ignored or to be, oh yeah, I'll be back in 5 minutes and you never come back, or, you know, cutting the patients off after 17 seconds, you know. I think that there is a great potential to technology being an enabler of empathy and human interaction.
And in our cathedrals of medicine, we often create silos and moats between ourselves and our patients, and empathy is nowhere found in sight. There's an excellent YouTube video by the Cleveland Clinic on empathy. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've seen it, and it's something that is so important. You know, it's so important. I cried with that video.
Yeah. Very powerful. Dr. Grossman, thank you for spending time with me. I am privileged and honored to call you a friend and a colleague in this space, and I hope to see you again soon.
Thank you very much, Greg. My pleasure, really, an honor.